From Odyssey, I'm Lauren Berry, and this is the On Deadline podcast, where you get a focused look at stories from our radio newsrooms across the country. Today On Deadline is looking at a massacre in Moscow and how it could affect Russia's ongoing fight with Ukraine and reverberate around the world, down to how much we pay for gas at the pump and who we'll vote for in November. On Friday, four gunmen opened fire at a theater near Moscow and slaughtered more than 100 Russians. The New York Times described it as a, quote, blow to Mr. Putin's aura as a leader for whom national security is paramount. In other words, President Vladimir Putin's message to Russians is that they need him to keep safe. But shortly after his reelection, the country had this, its deadliest attack since 2004. It's especially rattling since Russia has relatively few mass shootings. The U.S. had more than 100 of them in 2023, whereas Russia had just 21. Putin, seemingly unprepared, went dark for 19 hours after the attack, and then gave a 5-minute speech saying the culprits had acted just like Nazis, which harkens to his common claim that present-day Ukraine is run by neo-Nazis. Putin said that 11 people, including the four gunmen, had been detained by Russian authorities. He also shared that, despite the fact that the Islamist State, a terrorist group, already took claim for the attacks, he believed Ukraine had something to do with it. In a comment to Reuters, Andriy Yusov, a Ukrainian military intelligence spokesman, maintained that his country wasn't involved. Ukraine is defending its sovereignty from Russian invaders, liberating its own territory, and is fighting with the occupiers' army and military targets, not civilians, Yusov said. The United States has commented on the attack, with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken condemning all terror attacks. But what will this tragedy mean for Russia's war, and will it affect global issues moving forward? Don Jensen is a senior advisor at the U.S. Institute of Peace and a former diplomat at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. He joined Odyssey to explain.
There were many people online jumping to conclusions about who's responsible, which probably doesn't surprise you given the invasion of Ukraine and the chaos that Russia is causing. But when ISIS claimed responsibility, did it surprise you? Because you usually associate ISIS with attacks in Iraq and Afghanistan and Iran.
Well, it did at first, but then I realized that, of course, ISIS has a lot of Dagestani separatists fighting for it. That's the non-Russian ethnic region in southern Russia. And so along the Caucasus in a very volatile, dangerous area. And they've long fought there against the what they see as Russian oppression. So there is a natural link there. I'm not sure that it's here in this case, but it seems to be one of the most likely theories, I think, that they are North Caucasus separatists.
Is there any suspicion this is in retaliation for anything that Russia may have done in the Middle East?
Not really, because Russia has leaned, if I can be polite, toward Hamas in the crisis that began on October 7th. So that's unlikely. This is really more likely about the significant Muslim population inside Russia, the fact that the Southern Caucasus republics, going back to the war with Chechnya 20 years ago, they all want autonomy or independence from Moscow. That's more likely to be the explanation. But I think two other things need to be said here. One is that it's not likely or highly unlikely to be the Ukrainians who have prided themselves on even the attacks we've seen recently on not hitting civilian targets. They've targeted military and oil facilities. So it's highly unlikely to be the Ukrainians, no matter what Putin blames, whom Putin blames, or no matter what he says. And the other thing is that Putin, in his constant arrogance, poo-pooed a U.S. security warning at the embassy on March 8th, which warned American citizens, few that are left in Russia, to be careful outside because there were apparently to the embassy what they thought saw as credible security leaks. And then Putin crowed at a speech earlier this week that everything was under control. Well, clearly they're not. And that's not the first example we've seen in recent weeks about the Kremlin's grip being less firm than it might seem from the outside.
How do you suppose President Putin might respond? Is there any history with something like this and how he's responded in the past?
Oh, there's plenty. Putin, in several incidents early in his his reign, let's call it, used violence, even when it was not caused by the Kremlin, to use it as a pretext to crack down. And this could be used to tighten the screws further inside Russia. It could be used to justify a mobilization of troops. The Russians need several hundred thousand more if they're going to continue their current momentum on the battlefield. So there's a lot of ways that Putin can use, as somebody once said, a good crisis can't be wasted. He could move in that direction, too. The third explanation would be that the KGB just did it themselves to give a pretext for Putin. But the ISIS claim, I think, is very credible. And the opposition to the Kremlin by some ISIS members, I think, it seems to be a very, very possible explanation.
For more than 2 years now, Russian troops have been on the ground in Ukraine, creating numerous global issues. These include global supply chain kinks, partisan fighting in the U.S. over funding, and more. And there's a particularly sneaky outcome that shows how faraway wars can impact our daily lives here. We're paying more money for gas. Gas is one of the main factors of inflation that has people criticizing President Joe Biden as he struggles to overcome former President Donald Trump at the polls. Professor James Coleman from SMU joined Odyssey to discuss how the war is impacting those gas prices.
These gas prices are going to keep going up in the coming weeks and months. Some of that, there's so many different factors, but the drone attacks on Russian oil facilities are playing a part.
Yeah, that's right. One of the biggest factors right now that's just causing a spike in gasoline prices is it seems that Ukraine has demonstrated that with these drones, they're able to reach a large number of Russia's refineries. And, you know, we may expect them to be able to do that even more in the future. And of course, it may be that Russia develops some methods of trying to prevent these attacks or not. And that'll have an impact on what we see with gasoline prices going forward.
When we look at our reliance on these Russian oil facilities, can you explain that a little bit, you know, how that all works and how it ends up at our gas pump?
Yeah, it's a little bit funny because we don't actually import very much gasoline at all from Russia. We haven't, and we certainly don't now. But the issue is that it's a global market. And so because oil is so easy to transport across the world, when there's a shortage in one place, as there may be in Europe, they don't have those imports of Russian gasoline to depend on, or in Africa. Wherever there's a shortage, they end up importing more from places that have extra. And that can be the United States, that can be in from other oil producers, but it just means that there's less gasoline to go around. And so whenever there's any kind of impact around the world on oil or gasoline markets, it has an impact in Minnesota and everywhere.
This is the time of the year that we see this. It's a trend every time because the demand goes up. And then, of course, we've got the summer months ahead. There's also this arrival of this, what I've been hearing about, an expensive summer blend gas, which could increase pump prices by 10 to 15 cents. Is that kind of the trend that you're seeing?
Yes, that does happen every year about this time. And so basically what that is that there's different formulations of gasoline, and some are more prone to evaporation. And so we try not to use the gasoline that's more prone to evaporation during the summer months, because when it evaporates, it can cause problems in terms of ozone. And we don't want, those days where they tell you for sensitive groups, you know, maybe you should be worried about exercising outside. We don't want that to happen. And so we make refiners use a blend of gasoline that's less likely to cause that problem.
Okay. And do you see this kind of continuing to rise through the summer with all the travel ahead? Or what's kind of, as you read the tea leaves, what are you seeing?
Well, so no, that is kind of a one-time switch. And so that's, as you said, that's why it kind of leads to a one-time elevation in prices in the spring. And when people start, but then there's other factors that can change, like are people really driving more, right? You know, if the economy were to slow down and people were to say, well, we're not, you know, maybe we don't want to take that vacation, you might see gasoline prices ease and go down a little bit. I mean, it's interesting. You know, 4 years ago at this time, we had kind of rock bottom gasoline prices because of COVID, right? And so when COVID hit, people weren't using as much gasoline. So it's always will to be dependent on what kind of events we see in terms of how fast gasoline and oil demand is continuing around the world. Because it's global markets, it doesn't just depend on, you know, how that demand develops in the United States, but also in places like India and China that are using more and more fuel.
As the war continues to rage in Ukraine and in Gaza, many are beginning to wonder what stance the U.S. will take on global conflicts after November. With former President Donald Trump still leading current President Joe Biden in almost every poll, some people are concerned what that means when it comes to Russia. Will Putin back out of Ukraine? Will he put his foot on the pedal? Will Ukraine funding from the U.S. stop altogether? Javed Ali, a professor of practice at the University of Michigan who has worked in the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Department of Homeland Security, and at the FBI, joined Odyssey on the West Coast to discuss the possibilities.
How would it differ, the support of Ukraine differ, based on who would be elected president?
Well, if President Biden is reelected, then one would think that he would continue the strong U.S. support that has been provided to Ukraine over the past 3 going into 4 years. And that's probably totaling over $100 billion of weapons, materiel, equipment, economics, assistance, aid. And that number is probably even higher than the one that I've given. So the under President Biden, the U.S. has gone all in terms of supporting Ukraine, other than just putting U.S. troops on the ground, which President Biden has said he will not do, unless there's a circumstance that drives that. Right now, there isn't. And on the flip side, President Trump continues to make these comments saying that if he is reelected, that he would figure out a way to wind down the provision of the aid that has gone to Ukraine. That would also have to be worked out based on how things happen on the congressional front, because Congress is, up until now, even though this latest aid package has stalled out, has been also, you know, part of that equation of allowing all of that U.S. support to go to Ukraine. So I'm not sure if President Trump, even unilaterally under his Article 2 powers, is under the Constitution as Commander-in-Chief, if he were to be reelected, could completely turn everything off. But at the same time, I think he's signaling his intent at a strategic level that it will be a different relationship than the one that has existed under President Biden.
And how would that play into the historical narrative that the U.S. just has no staying power on military adventures like this? We start, and then there's a change of leadership or a change of public perception, and then we stop.
Well, we were fairly consistent for years, if not a couple decades, first in Iraq and then in Afghanistan. But eventually, those campaigns wound down. Now, different type of conflict where we ourselves were putting our troops in harm's way and spending even more, you know, vastly more money than what has been provided to Ukraine. But yes, we eventually withdrew from Iraq in August 2021, we withdrew from Afghanistan. So these types of conflicts, it's always hard to predict when will you leave and how will you define your sort of criteria of leaving and what does victory look like, even when the U.S. has more invested in it. With Ukraine, it's different. We don't have troops on the ground, and this isn't necessarily a U.S. fight per se, but we're supporting Ukraine to sort of by proxy. And at what point does that U.S. support, even if President Biden gets reelected, will it be another $100 or $200 billion for the next 4 years? That's an open question. Will, based on the battlefield developments, will there be some kind of ceasefire in place that puts a stop to the fighting? And then, you know, both sides will have to live with whatever that post-conflict landscape looks like. We also don't know if that will happen, no matter who the U.S. President is. But I do think right now in 2024, this is a really pivotal year for Ukraine, because if Congress can't get this latest aid package passed through, and if President Trump does get reelected, then I do think it'll be very difficult for Ukraine to do what they've been able to do the last 3 or 4 years against Russia.
Does Trump's talk about NATO worry you at all? I mean, especially given new NATO membership?
Again, it's hard to kind of know where President Trump is going on this, because, as you mentioned, NATO has expanded even since when he was president, and he wouldn't have unilateral authority to decouple or decommit the United States from NATO. That would have to be worked out with
Congress, and Congress may not go along with that. But I think he is more trying to send the NATO members a message that it can't, even for the conflict in Ukraine, that it can't just be the U.S. giving the lion's share of the support to Ukraine. These other countries have to fulfill their obligations. He was saying that when he was president in 2017 through 2020. And I think he's just going to reinforce that same message that, you know, sort of the threat of the withdrawal, I don't think that would actually happen. But it's more, I think, a gambit to get other NATO countries who aren't pulling their weight to hit that 2% GDP mark for spending. But I don't see a realistic scenario where President Trump would withdraw, because again, he'd have to have Congress. He'd have to have a partnership with Congress in order to do that. And I don't think there's a stomach in Congress to do that right now.
A poll released by the Chicago Council of Global Affairs last month found that 58% of Americans support sending more aid to Ukraine. While the number remains high, it has steadily declined over the past 25 months. With the presidential election just around the corner and key issues of the economy, immigration, abortion, and more on the table, stay tuned to On Deadline to keep up to date on what you need to know before you cast your ballot. This show is produced by Joe Heedy, Christy Strouser, and Myron Kaplan. And by me. I'm Lauren Berry, and I want to say thanks for listening to On Deadline, Odyssey's serving of a top news story just for you. Subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts to stay informed.